I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of the novel, which is set in Auckland in June of 1886. And the main character, Paratene Te Manu, is down in Auckland for a few days to attend some hearings at the Native Land Court. And he's staying at what was then called the Native Hostel by the waterfront. And I'm just going to read some excerpts from that chapter. Last time I was in Auckland, when the trees were still bristling with leaves, I was asked to pose for a photograph. I was happy to do this, even though it was quite a to-do. Someone has made pictures of me before in a proper studio, in a proper city, so I know what to expect. But this photographer just had a room behind a chemist shop and a blanket hanging on the wall. His hair was slick with oil. He insisted that I wear a peacock feather tucked behind one ear. He stuck it there himself, and his fingers were as greasy as his hair. This feather was quite ridiculous. Then he covered my jacket with a great cloak, a kaitaka, but he draped it upside down over my shoulders. He wanted the woven border of taniko work to show in the picture, he said. I was an ancient warrior, he told me, as though this would explain why I was wearing a peacock feather and an upside down cloak. When I say he told me, I mean to say this. He told my old friend Wharepapa to explain things to me in Māori. I could understand his English, but I didn't let the photographer know that. I don't even let Wharepapa know that. People speak more when they think you don't understand. One of my eyes doesn't see too good these days. I stood looking away from the camera. Does the old man think the photograph will insult him in some way? He asked Wharepapa. Does he think it will steal his spirit? Yes, said Wharepapa without a smile, although I'm sure he thought this was a great joke. Paratene Te Manu, the last of the ancient warriors, the photographer said, almost to himself, and then Wharepapa grew restless. He fancies himself quite handsome and vigorous still, and likes to tell people of the old days when he too was a great warrior. He doesn't often say this when I'm there, because we both know that I was fighting with my second Toa when he was still a gurgling baby, strapped to his mother's back. Almost everything he says about battles are stories he heard from his uncles. The picture was taken, and there was an end to it, I thought. But this week, at the Native Hostel, one old fool tells me he's seen my face, pinned to the wall somewhere along Queen Street. I don't take any notice until Wharepapa comes thudding down the hill from his house in Parnell, seeking me out on the beach where I'm smoking my pipe. The Bohemian painter is back in Auckland, he tells me. He's taken over a small room in Mr. Partridge's building and is working from the photographs taken in town earlier this year. You should talk to him, Wharepapa advises. Otherwise he'll paint your picture with that peacock feather. People will say you're an Indian princess. Wharepapa thinks this is so funny. He repeats it to everyone in Mechanics Bay. I wish I was back up north on Hauturu, tending my garden, away from the chatter and intrigues of this place. So, a little later in the chapter, Paratene heads off on a rainy Auckland day, very unusual thing, to find Lindauer. I set off Queen Street, walking towards Mr. Partridge's shop. The street is crunchy with mud and stones, and rain starts falling again. The first time I saw this city, when my son was a small boy, none of these buildings were here. It was a settlement, not even daring to call itself a city. None of these docks or wide roads, just tracks cut into a deep bed of fern, the sea lapping up. This wide road and the hill where horses had the big trams up to the ridge, that was all water. Some parts of it were a stream clogged with clumps of flax. Some parts of it were just a swamp. All you could see was the thatch of ferns and clusters of manuka trees with their spindly arms and legs whispering in the wind. In later years, when it started calling itself a city, things weren't much better in Auckland. There was a church and a fort up on the point, but the whare were only replaced with shops and houses that a gust could blow down. Whenever it rained, the track along the stream turned into a bog, and to climb it was to walk in treacle. We used to laugh at them, those Pākehā, trying to press their town into the soggy hill and moving dirt and rocks to fill in the sea. We always camped down by the bay, where the Native Hostel and market stand now, easier to get in and out. They also tried to build a fort around the stream to make it a canal, but really it was a dirty gully where people emptied their piss pots, and it looked and smelled like the prickled mud around mangroves at low tide. You had to cross it by walking on planks. At night, when people were drunk and nobody could see anything, they'd fall in. This was the best show going in Auckland for years, Wharepapa always said. That, and people tumbling off the rickety wharf they built, the one that collapsed a few years ago. Not to mention visiting the stocks and gallows, though they don't have these near Queen Street anymore. So Paratenig finds Mr. Partridge's shop, where you can buy tobacco and other things, and he goes upstairs to find the bohemian painter, Lindau. He just always refers to him as the bohemian, actually, all the way through the book. Because of the rain pelting the window, the room is quite dark. The only light is from a kerosene lamp and a small ashy fire in the grate. I know I'm in the right place because it smells of paint and many Māori faces are pinned to the wall. The bohemian, sitting in a chair in the corner, is drinking from a teacup. He peers at me through small round glasses. With his sharp face and his hooded eyes, he looks like a bird at night, huddling in the darkness. He knows my name, which surprises me at first, but of course he must recognize me from the photograph that was taken. I can't see the picture myself. There are too many up on the wall. I thought you will come, he says. His English sounds worse than mine. Your friend tells me. Wharepapa. He has the biggest mouth in Auckland. The bohemian pulls papers off a low chair so I can sit down, and he finds the photograph to show me. I look angry in the picture. My white whiskers stick through the ridges of my moko, so my face is like a frayed mat. I'm staring off to the side, my left eye milky, fuming about the peacock feather. I should never have agreed to it. You paint my face, not this one, I tell him, jabbing at the photograph. It's strange to hear myself speaking English out loud. No feather. I smack my left ear so he understands about the feather, and the bohemian smiles. Next week I go away, he says. He's looking hard at my face, and then without saying anything, he leans forward to take the photograph from my hands. His own hands are thin and veined with blue. He looks at the photograph for a long time. The only noise is the patter of rain against the glass and a tired hiss from the fireplace. Then he gets up and pokes at the fire with the irons. I go away too, I say, until October. The bohemian tells me he's not going to be in Auckland anymore this year. He's going to England for an exhibition. But perhaps, the bohemian doesn't finish his sentence. He looks at me and taps his chin. 1, 2, 3. The last time a painter looked at me, it was very different from this. That painter had a bush of hair, wild eyes, and thick hands that crushed the pencil he was holding. He came to our lodgings and drew me and then another person and then another person, wriggling in his seat all the while. Months passed before any of us saw the painting. It was very big, and no one could recognize himself in it. In the picture, we were all standing in a room at John Wesley's house, a place we'd visited once or twice. I can't remember. This all took place in London. I must tell the bohemian that I, Paratene Te Manu, have been to London and had been painted before, and that the painting was very large indeed. I won't tell him that in this painting I was on the edge of things and looked like a child trying to hide from view, rather than a rangatira and the oldest person in the room, the only one among them to have fought alongside the great hongi. The English don't understand these things. Perhaps bohemians don't either. Can you come tomorrow, he asks me. We meet tomorrow and again on Monday and Tuesday maybe. I agree to this. There's little else for me to do in Auckland these days except spend money and hear people talk about bad omens, and neither of these things is good for me at all. You talk to me about London, yes? The bohemian is smiling again. He pins my photograph back on the wall. I know you spent much time there, years ago, with your friend Wharepapa. Wharepapa should write stories for the Auckland Weekly News. He likes to shout his business up and down the town. I'm sure he's told the bohemian that without him, without his personal invitation, I would never have gone to England. This annoys me so much I start muttering bad words and banging my stick on the floor. The painter, who I think does not understand Māori, glances at the window as though he's eager for the day to be over. "Tomorrow," he says, bowing to me, and I let him help me up from the chair. This weather makes my bones creak. When I leave the Bohemian's little studio, I walk down Queen Street towards the water, making my way back toward the native hostel. The canal of shit is covered over now, but the city still smells, especially when the wind blows the smoke from the big sawmills at Te Tō. I could cut down Fort Street, but I don't want to. Old men like me remember when this was 4th Street, when its shacks and stables used to gaze out to sea. Now it's a foul and bedraggled place, fed by the muddy alleys where harpies lurk, waiting for night to fall and the sailors to stagger along into their arms. Here on Queen Street, a lot of the old shops have burned down and been replaced. These grand banks with their pillars and railings, these shops with the big letters outside, the trams that have to be pushed and dragged up the hill, even these flat footpaths supposed to keep your shoes dry, they're all new. If you stood in the middle of Queen Street looking at all the false fronts and the gas lamps and the men hurrying about their business, you might think this is a real city now, but it's not. I've seen a real city, the biggest city in the world, and whatever that chattering kaka whare papa has to say, it was nothing to do with him.